I know we are, I say, feeling guilty for what I've done, for worrying B like this. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have brought Meredith up. That was stupid of me, I say, though I'm glad I did it. I got the answer I was looking for. I came out of the appointment with exactly what I was hoping to get. A gut reaction telling me that yes, this is a man who could hurt another human being. The rear windshield starts to clear. As it does, the street behind me becomes minimally visible, enough to see a pair of headlights riding my tail from behind. At first, I think nothing of it. I wish only that the other driver would slow down. The roads are wet. They're slick. I can feel the slipperiness and the unpredictability of the street in my hands as I cling tightly to the steering wheel, going below the speed limit. The rain comes down so quickly that the wipers can't keep up. It makes it difficult, if not nearly impossible, to see. I focus my attention on the taillights of the car in front of me and try to keep in a straight line. But I can't see the markings on the street to know for certain if I'm between the white lines or if I've glided over them into oncoming traffic. As we pass the cars that move in the opposite direction of us, I hold my breath, hoping and praying that there's enough space between us because I don't honestly know. I keep at a safe distance from the driver before me. It's safer that way, in case he or she needs to slam on the brakes. And because the spray of rainwater from their tires only exacerbates my visibility problem. I only wish the driver behind me would do the same. He's close to rear-ending me. The rain brings out the worst in drivers. I step on the gas, hoping to widen the distance between us. But it doesn't help because this other driver only speeds up as I do, still riding my tail. I can't get a good look at the car. The rain is thick. It's impossible to see through, other than where cars or traffic signals emit light. What's wrong? B asks, sensing my growing agitation. This idiot driver is riding my tail, I say. B takes a cursory glance in the side mirror. Just take your time, she says. He can go around us if he wants. B keeps talking. She's talking about what's just happened with Dr. Feingold, I think. But what she's specifically saying, I don't know, because I've unintentionally tuned her out. My attention is honed in on this car behind us. I'm trying not to panic, wishing that this other driver would do what B said, get in the left lane and pass. He's making me a nervous wreck, but I don't feel comfortable speeding up. Not that it would necessarily matter because he'd just go faster too. I close in on an intersection. I've lost all sense of direction because of the rain. I can't get my bearings and realize almost too quickly that this intersection is where I need to turn to go home. Without thinking or indicating, I yank on the steering wheel and we sharply turn. The street must be lower in the intersection because the standing water is deep. For a second, the car loses traction and I think we're about to hydroplane. I resist the urge to slam on the brakes, riding it out instead, letting the car self-correct. B falls into me. What was that? She asks, panicked, as I regain control of the car. B rights herself on the seat, staring out the window to orient herself to where we are. Sorry, I say, feeling breathless, my heart racing over what just happened. I almost missed the turn. Yeah, well, she says. You could have taken another one. You could have turned around in a parking lot. What are you trying to do, kill us, Kate? I go quiet. I focus on the road. I hate it when B and I fight. She's angry with me, but she's also angry for me because of what happened with Dr. Feingold. While I endured his pelvic exam, she was forced to watch. That must have been as awful for her as it was for me. We've both come undone. B knows this as well as me. Her tone softens. She lays a hand on my arm. You want to pull over and I'll drive? You've been through a lot today, and this weather is the pits. Why don't you let me drive, Kate? I shrug her off. I've got it. I'm fine. Besides, we're almost home. I glance into the rearview mirror. That same car is still riding our tail. The driver made the same last-minute 90-degree turn as me. I become hyper-aware. This driver is following us. He doesn't want to lose sight of B and me. It's the reason he follows so closely, because he doesn't want to allow enough room for another car to slip in and separate us. I feel it in my gut. I try so hard to get a look at the driver, but his car and his face are fuzzy and indistinct because of the rain. If it wasn't for headlights tailing me, I might not know someone was there. I say to B, I think that car is following us.
What car?
She asks. The one behind us, riding my tail.
B turns in her seat to look out the rear window.
Who is it? She asks.
Can you tell?
This damn rain, I say. I can't get a good look. B and I left the medical building together. We were in the elevator alone. No one was with us. Dr. Feingold could have conceivably taken the stairs and followed us out that way. B and I were so distracted in the parking lot that we nearly ran to the car, arguing, desperate to get out of the pelting rain. We didn't pay attention to who else was in the parking lot with us. Dr. Feingold could have been 10 feet behind and we wouldn't have known.
Maybe it's that car you cut off leaving the doctor's office, she says. He was pissed. People get road rage.
That driver passed me, I remind her. He's gone. We're still miles from our house. I'm panicking, not wanting to lead this person directly to where B and I live. Though, if it is Dr. Feingold, that doesn't matter because I've already given him my address. How stupid I've been. I keep driving because I can't think of anything else to do. If this person's intent is to scare and intimidate us, then they've succeeded. I practically lose the ability to drive because I'm so nervous. I drive slowly, hands locked on the 10-2 position.
Just try and ignore him, B says.
But that's easier said than done. She leans forward in her seat to turn the radio on, a nice distraction. We don't speak. Before I know it, I'm closing in on our home. I'm just a few miles from it, and still not sure what to do. I can't go home. I can't lead this individual to our house. Who's to say what he'll do when we get there? Though for the first time ever, I take comfort in the fact that our house likely swarms with workers. Certainly no one would harm B or me while witnesses watch on. It's just by dumb luck that we pass the police station on the way home. It becomes visible through the rain, only because a patrol car with lights and sirens blazing comes speeding out of the parking lot as we draw near. Certainly the driver of this other car wouldn't be stupid enough to follow us into the police station parking lot. As I approach the parking lot, I turn my signal on and ease up on the gas. I make the turn into the parking lot as the other car switches lanes and accelerates down the road, leaving a spray of rainwater in its wake. Both B and I try, but neither of us manages to get a good look at the driver or the license plate. It's all just a blur, indecipherable in the rain.
Leo. Now. On your third day home, you start talking about some kid named Gus. It's by accident that it happens. Someone's playing ball outside. The thump of the ball hitting concrete carries inside. It gets your attention. It's just a basketball, Dad says, seeing that you've gone white. Ever since you've been home, Dad's neurotic about keeping doors and windows shut and locked, the blinds closed. You can never be too careful. He spends his nights awake. He sits in the parlor and reads. No one's taking you on his watch. Gus plays basketball, you say. Dad looks up from his scrambled eggs and asks, who's Gus? You tell him. Dad goes white too. He excuses himself and leaves the room, taking his cell phone with him. You weren't alone in that basement. Someone was with you. Someone got left behind. We drive back down to the police station. The lady cop becomes more assertive in her questioning. She no longer tiptoes around you like you might break. Now that we know someone else is still there, it's time, she says, to get down to business. She asks what you know about this kid, Gus. You don't know much. You can't even tell the lady cop what he looks like because, for all your time together, you never got a good look at his face. You don't know how old he is. You don't know where he's from. The lady cop looks in those missing kids databases. She and her henchmen come up with a handful of missing kids named Gus, or some variation of it. Argus, Augustus, Gustavo. They show you pictures and ask if any of them is your Gus. You don't know. A missing kid from Cookeville, Tennessee might be, you think. But really, you don't know. You're just trying to please the lady cop by saying something. I probably would too. I spent a lot of time on those missing kids websites when you were gone. Did you know that? Here's the cracked thing about those sites. Not only do they have pictures of the missing kids that they're looking for, sometimes what they have is found skeletal remains, and they're trying to figure out who they belong to. They call these kids Jane and John. There are a bajillion of them, just red and blue dots all over a map. One dot for each unidentifiable body they've found. Cops don't know who they are, but they're in bad shape when they find them, or parts of them anyway. There's no end to the evil things people will do to one another. When you were gone, I spent a lot of time online wondering if you were going to be one of the unidentifiable. I told Dad about these kids. He took my internet away for a month. I never mentioned them again. I wasn't stupid enough to suggest to Dad that you were skeletal remains. Still, I put the idea in his head. The lady cop asks you a lot of questions. You know nothing. We get nowhere. When they first found you, a local cop drove you around and around that town, trying to see if you could remember where you'd been. But other than identifying smokestacks and a fence, you were clueless. I looked that town up on the internet, if it can even be called a town. You have to zoom in real close on the map to see it. It's called Michael, and has a population of about 45. It's 5 hours from our place, somewhere close to the Mississippi, in an area that's all farmland and trees. Every year, it floods. From the couple of pictures I saw of it on the internet, it's pretty skeevy. Vacant storefronts with boarded up and broken windows. Decrepit farmhouses. The only other houses besides farmhouses are tornado bait, aka mobile homes. Makes me wonder how you ended up there. Dad's the one who suggests hypnosis to see if that will help dredge up memories about Mom, about Gus. The lady cop isn't going for it. She says you're not in the right state of mind for that. It's true. You're shell-shocked. You don't sleep. And even when you do, you have nightmares. You wake up sweating and screaming. You sleep on the basement floor at night because it's the only place you can actually sleep. You can't look anyone in the eye. You're afraid of running water. You shit bricks when the elementary school bus drives by. Someone's child, Dad tells the lady cop, is still missing. Mine is home. I can't have that on my conscience.
Meredith, 11 years before. May. The Tebow's baby is covered in forceps marks and bruising when she arrives. Within minutes of her birth, her tiny head begins to swell. Within hours, she begins to seize. A cranial head ultrasound is performed, where doctors discover an intracranial hemorrhage, otherwise known as a brain bleed. The cause? Excessive mechanical force to her head, resulting from forceps misuse. The baby's condition improves by the time she's allowed to go home, but even when she does go home, there's much uncertainty about her future. The days and weeks pass. The Tebows meet with an attorney. They decide to sue Dr. Feingold for malpractice. Shelby calls and asks if I think it's a good idea. Jason says we're doing it, whether I like it or not. He's pissed. Dr. Feingold screwed up. This isn't for me to decide. You have to do what's right for your family, I tell her. She has a case. I was there. I saw with my own eyes. I saw him do things to Shelby's body without her consent, things that carried a great deal of risk. A malpractice suit can't change anything that's happened. Their baby will likely have special needs. A settlement could help pay for the baby's care. If I can help in any way, I will. Whatever you and Jason need. The attorney looks through Shelby's and the baby's medical records. He speaks with medical experts. He decides that the Tebows have a case. The next week, Dr. Feingold receives the medical malpractice complaint. The first thing he does is call me.
Those folks wouldn't know their ass from their elbow. Far be it for them to decide that I did something wrong. You put the idea into their head.
I shouldn't be speaking to you, I say.
If you did this, he says, if this was your idea, I'll ruin you. Do you hear me? I will ruin you.
He enunciates one word at a time. I will ruin you. I hang up the phone. My whole body shakes long after I do. For over an hour, I sit at the kitchen table, unable to move. My thoughts dwell on one thing. How will he ruin me, exactly? Will he ruin my career? Or will he physically ruin me? Josh comes home with the kids. They're bubbly, loud. Delilah is excited. Their classroom is getting caterpillars. When they turn into butterflies, they'll release them outside. She hugs me. She's getting taller. Her arms, when she wraps them around me, reach my waist. She asks me,
when can I have a play date with Piper and stupid Lily Morris?
Delilah, I tell her, we don't call anybody stupid.
But she is,
she pouts. Delilah, I warn. My voice is stern.
Fine, but when can we have a play date? And does Lily Morris have to come?
She pleads. She sets her hands on her hips. One juts out. Only six, and already she has a flair for the dramatic. I smile at her, wishing life could only be this complex. I do feel badly for her. I know how hard it is to be left out. Yes, I tell her, Lily Morris has to come, because we don't want to leave anyone out. That doesn't feel good, does it? Once the kids leave, I tell Josh, I was just about to start dinner. In the next room, the TV turns on. I haven't so much as thought about dinner.
How about we order something? He suggests.
I like that idea. I don't feel like cooking. My stomach is in knots. I don't even know that I could eat. Josh is looking at me. He's incredibly handsome. Josh has always been incredibly handsome. He's dapper. His suit is slim-fitting, navy. He has many suits. While other men collect cigars or license plates, Josh collects suits. Some are tailor-made and others off the rack. He's always trying to impress. He has a likable personality, a gravitational field. People are drawn to him. He's outgoing. His smile lights up a room. Everyone likes Josh. I should trust him enough to tell him what happened to the Tebows, what's happening with Dr. Feingold, and about the threatening texts. But he would be disappointed after the fact. And he would worry. He would want to know how and why I got myself into this situation to begin with. And then he'd want to completely revamp the way I do my work to some other formula where he believes I'm at less personal and professional risk. But I love what I do. I love the way that I do it. I put the Tebows and Dr. Feingold out of my mind. Soon it will be through.
Leo. Now. Around the same time you disappeared, some other lady did too. They found her, except that by the time they did, she was already dead. For a while, cops thought it was all connected. They were wrong. Now, the lady's husband is in the slammer. He'll be there for a long time. 20 to life, because they found her bloody clothes in a dumpster behind where he worked. That night, the lady cop calls Dad on the phone. He takes it into another room because he doesn't want you to hear what she's saying. But when I ask, he tells me. Turns out, the people who took you were dumb enough to use their real names, because there is a real Eddie and Martha Cutter living in Michael, Illinois. Eddie and Martha own a house on Calhoun Street. They've owned it 12 years. The lady cop texts Dad a picture. It's not the nicest house, because half of its shutters are missing, and there's mildew on the white siding. The trees grow out of control, nearly hiding the house. The inside is 10 times worse. It's filthy. The carpet is stained. There's water damage on the walls, turned black with mold. There's standing water on the floor. Dirty dishes pile up in the kitchen sink. The only problem is that Eddie and Martha are not living there anymore, because when the cops went to investigate, the house was abandoned. Detective Rawlings is trying to locate their family to see if they know anything about their whereabouts. I'm wondering what happens if they try and come here. There are no pictures of the basement. The lady cop told Dad about the conditions they kept you in, but Dad can't tell me because he's too busy crying his eyes out. Your friend Gus was nowhere in sight. There was blood in the basement. You get the idea. There's more urgency about getting your memories back. The lady cop doesn't come right out and say it, but she thinks hypnosis is bullshit. But Dad looked into it and said that if they can relax you enough, you might just remember something your mind has been keeping from you. The night before the hypnosis, we're all getting ready for bed. You're in your bedroom, Dad's in his. From the hall, I hear you making noise in your room. I wonder what you're up to in there. I go to see. You're not so hesitant when you open the door, like maybe you're getting the hang of Dad and me. What are you doing in here? I ask, looking around. The lights in the room are off. Nothing, you say. You're sheepish. You don't want to tell me. You must be doing something. It's something stupid, you say. Like what? Just a game I play. What's it called? I ask. It don't really have a name. How do you play it? You don't want to, but you show me anyway, after a while of me begging. You think I'm going to make fun of you for it. I don't. Instead, I play your game with you. It's not super dark in your room because of a light from down the hall, so you close the bedroom door, trapping both you and me inside. Still, it's not black. Outside your window, the moon is bright. It's better when you can't see nothing, you tell me. Why's it better? I ask. It just is. That's how the game is played. We got to close our eyes, you say, to make up for the lack of blackness. You tell me to keep my hands at my sides. It's cheating, you say, if you feel with your hands first. We stand with our backs to one wall. The object of the game, you tell me, is to be the one to get closest to the opposite wall without running into it. We can't use our hands. I try. I fail. I feel like a fish out of water trying to walk with my eyes closed. I can't even walk in a straight line. I plow into the bed frame and give up. This game is dumb, but I don't tell you that. But I watch as you keep going. You stop within a centimeter of the wall, like you had some sixth sense that it was there. How'd you do that? I ask. You tell me it's one of those things you got real good at, finding your way around in the dark. There wasn't no light where they kept us, you say. None at all. When someone takes your eyes away from you, you figure out how to get by on other things. So that's what you did. You learned to survive on your other senses and on instinct. It's pretty cool. Wanna play again? You ask. I don't. Not really. There's a stinging pain in my thigh from where I ran into the bed frame. Chances are good it'll bruise. I don't feel like doing that again. Still, I shrug my shoulders and say, why not? 'Cause I can tell it's what you want to do.
Meredith. 11 years before. May. I haven't forgotten about Cassandra. I've been busy. But all the while, she's been on my mind. I want to be a better friend to her than I've been. I've been so busy burdening her with my needs that I've forgotten about hers. Something is off with Cassandra. I have to know what it is. On a Friday afternoon, I pick up a bundt cake from the local bakery. After Delilah is in school and Leo with Charlotte, I walk it to Cassandra's house. I go to her door and knock. She answers with Arlo in her arms. What are you doing here? She asks. Her tone is curt. I present the bundt cake. I thought we could talk. It feels like we never have the time to just talk anymore. I miss you, Cassandra, I say. She harumphs, which is how I know that she's really put out about something. Come in, she tells me. I step inside and out of my shoes. You want coffee? She asks. I tell her yes, following her into the kitchen. Cassandra wears a dress, which she almost always does. It's long and cotton and comfortable looking, but still a dress. She looks lovely in it. I can't remember the last time I wore a dress. I'm glad you stopped by, she says, as I help myself to a chair. I watch her brew a pot of coffee one-handed with Arlo in the other. It's effortless. I would have dropped either Arlo or the coffee by now. I've been wanting to for a while. Things have been so busy. I have something I want to show you. Oh? I ask, thinking it's something having to do with the kids. Something having to do with Delilah, Piper, Lily, and their little squabble. I hope that Delilah hasn't done something she shouldn't have, like give Lily Morris a mean picture. Cassandra brings a book to the table. It's a photo album. People don't keep photo albums anymore. Everything is digital these days. If anything, people scrapbook. Scrapbooks are lovely. But I don't have the time for that. The album shows its age. The plastic photo sleeves bend. The pictures themselves look old, taken with a 35mm camera. No one has cameras anymore. Cassandra thumbs through to a certain page. She lays the album flat when she finds it. I see enough red to know what it is. The name of my alma mater is written on almost every t-shirt and sweatshirt in the book. We lived in campus gear when we were in college. She points to a picture. There I am. There Marty is. My cheeks go flush. I have a hard time swallowing. My saliva is suddenly thick. Her voice quavers when she speaks, in both anger and pain. She asks, why wouldn't you and Marty tell me unless you had something to hide? I've known for weeks what you two were up to, she goes on, without waiting for an answer. You thought you could get away with it. She doesn't know that we dated, that we slept together. But the picture is damning enough. In it, we stand side by side. Marty's arm is thrown around my shoulders. It's casual, comfortable. We knew each other. We knew each other well. That we didn't tell her and Josh looks bad. If I told you that nothing has happened between Marty and me, would you believe me? I ask. You could try, but I wouldn't believe you. I look her in the eye. She looks away. She sets Arlo in his seat and cuts him a piece of the cake. I tell her, nothing has happened between Marty and me in 18 years. She looks back to me. But something did happen between Marty and you? That was a long time ago, Cassandra. We didn't know you back then. You didn't exist to us. But you dated? It was only young love. She looks aghast when I say this. You loved him? I regret my choice of words immediately. I should have phrased it differently. I never should have said the word love. I thought I did. I was blinded by all those overpowering emotions that we feel when we're 18. But now I know that it wasn't love at all. Cassandra, what you and Marty have is love. That was just naivete, infatuation, two stupid kids. Why should I believe anything you say, she asks, when you've been lying to me all this time? I never lied, I remind her. You've been keeping secrets from me, keeping me in the dark. Cassandra is a gorgeous woman. She's elegant and articulate and savvy and smart. In no way would Marty want me now that he has Cassandra. But it's hard to know these things about ourselves. Cassandra feels deceived. We did it for your sake. For yours and Josh's, I say. Cassandra sits upright. Does Josh know? She asks. I tell her, no. I couldn't bring myself to tell him. Not that it mattered either way, because there is nothing going on with Marty and me. I swear to you, Cassandra, on my life, on my children's lives, there is nothing going on between Marty and me. Did you sleep with him? She asks. Cassandra, don't do this. Did you? She demands. We've both forgotten all about the coffee and cake. The cake sits beside us. Only Arlo eats it. The coffee has finished brewing. It waits for us in the pot. I was 18, I say. It's not the answer she's looking for. So you did sleep with him then? Cassandra, answer the question, Meredith. Did you or did you not sleep with my husband? She's yelling now. In his high chair, Arlo gets scared. To appease him, Cassandra offers up another slice of cake. I watch him take it by the handful, shove it in until he's covered with it. There's cake in his hair. I did, I whisper, though he wasn't her husband then. But to remind her of that would only make her more upset. Things go from bad to worse quickly. Cassandra already knew I'd slept with Marty before she asked, because wedged between two pages of the photo album is a note, folded in half, that I wrote him over a decade and a half ago. I know what it is as she unfolds it and forces it into my hands. I can't bring myself to read the note, though I know what it says. After months of dating, I'd gotten pregnant. The baby was Marty's. I was fully intent on keeping the baby, which I explained to Marty in the note. He could be a part of the baby's life, if he so chose, but there was no obligation. As it turned out, he didn't have to choose, because 2 days later I miscarried. What did you do with the baby? She asks. We lost it at 12 weeks.
Shame, she says icily.
It terrifies Cassandra, knowing how close Marty came to having a child that wasn't hers. If I hadn't miscarried, Marty and I may have raised the child together. We may have gotten married. The life she knows might not have existed.
Are you still fucking my husband? She asks coolly, and I gasp. Of course not, I breathe out. I'm not stupid, she says. I know.
Know what? I ask, truly confused.
I know what you and he are up to. His late-night grocery store runs. Those 10 o'clock ice cream cravings.
She puts it all in air quotes, implying she doesn't for a minute think Marty runs off to the grocery store that late at night because he's craving ice cream.
Do you know that sometimes he thinks I'm so dense I won't realize how he comes home empty-handed? He doesn't even bother picking up ice cream as part of his charade. He just goes and fucks you and comes back. And then he climbs into bed with me, 9 times out of 10 forgetting to put back on his ring.
It saddens me to think of Marty sneaking out late at night to cheat on her. Though I can't say I find it shocking. Not because of anything Cassandra has done or not done, but because the Marty I knew in college was slick. He was a ladies' man. Maybe he hasn't changed as much as I thought. What shocks me is that Cassandra thinks that I, too, slip out of my house at 10 o'clock some nights, leaving Josh and the kids behind, and go to meet up with Marty. Cassandra, if Marty is seeing another woman, I say, it isn't me.
And why should I believe you, Meredith? Why should I believe anything you say?
I've never lied to you, I say.
Bullshit!
She snaps, again startling Arlo. I've never seen Cassandra so angry. I've never heard her use this language in front of her kids. I don't blame her for being upset, especially if she believes there's something going on between Marty and me. Still, she's taking it to the extreme.
You have lied to me, Meredith! You've been lying to me since the day we met!
If I did, it was lying by omission and not an outright lie. There's a difference.
Is there? She asks.
I say nothing. In truth, I don't know that there is.
When do you plan to tell Josh? She asks.
It isn't so much a question as it is an ultimatum. I'll tell him, if that's what you want me to do, I say. I'll tell him now that Cassandra knows. But I want to be able to tell him on my own terms. I don't want Cassandra to be the one who tells him. Please let me speak to him first, before you do.
I wouldn't do that to you, Meredith, she says. I'm not that kind of friend.
It's a slap in the face. She isn't the kind of person who would hurt a friend, but I am. I rise from the chair. I show myself to the door. She follows. At the door, I turn to face her. I'm so sorry that we didn't tell you, I say in a last-ditch effort to apologize. Marty and I thought it was for the best.
Marty and I! Marty and I!
She parrots. Her anger tangible. She's red in the face, her poise and aplomb gone. She believes that Marty is cheating on her with me. That if, or when, he sneaks out of his house late at night to rendezvous with some woman, that woman is me. It's not, of course. My marriage means everything to me. Josh means everything to me. I would never do something like that to him. Or to Cassandra, for that matter. I'm not that kind of woman. There's nothing that I can say to make her believe me. It's best that I just leave. As I step through the doorframe, Cassandra barks out,
I hope you rot in hell, Meredith! I hope you both rot in hell!
I can't help but notice how her word choice is a carbon copy of the threatening texts I've been receiving. The language of the texts returns to me. I know what you did. I hope you die. You'll never get away with it, bitch. I hope you rot in hell, Meredith. Cassandra has been the one sending me these texts. I wheel around to face her. It was you, I say, more shocked than anything. There's a tremor in my voice. You're the one who's been sending me those awful texts. You're the one who's been trying to scare the shit out of me. Did it work? She asks, satisfied in herself because she can see that it has. Were you following me? I ask, aghast, thinking of the time a text arrived just as I was leaving the hospital, as if the sender knew I was on my way home and alone. If I was, she asks, would it be anywhere as awful as what you've done? As what you're still doing? I consider the threatening, hateful wording of the texts. Was she hyperbolizing only? Or does she want me dead? Do I have a reason to be scared for my safety? For my life? I've done nothing, I say, trying to justify again how Marty and I withheld the information about our past for her sake, for Josh's. We didn't do it to hurt anyone. But I barely get the words out before the door slams closed, a deadbolt slipping into place on the other side. I won't let Delilah play with Piper. Delilah begs, please, Mommy, please! She wants to know why. When I tire of making excuses, I snap at her, because Mommy said so! Feeling guilty for losing my patience with Delilah. It's not her fault. It's mine. I can't go outside and face Cassandra. But I also can't trust her to watch my child. The next day, they have Lily Morris over to play. Cassandra must purposefully send the girls into the front yard to rub it in Delilah's face. She sits in the front window and cries, heartbroken that she hasn't been invited. Not that I would have allowed her to go, even if she was. Piper and Lily dance around the front yard, laughing, holding hands. I'm appalled that Cassandra would stoop so low as to hurt my child in an effort to get back at me. In the coming days, Leo continues to cry every time I leave him with Charlotte. He clings to me and begs, no, Mommy, no! I feel awful making him go. I think about calling in sick to work, staying home with Leo. But doing so would only be a disservice to him, because the days he has to go would then be 10 times worse. I make deals with Leo. I bargain with him. If you don't cry all week, Mommy and Leo will do something special on the weekend, just you and me. I tell him we'll go to the Children's Museum together or to the Children's Garden at the Arboretum if the weather cooperates. His pick. The mommy guilt is getting to me. I spend time thinking about quitting the yoga studio, about taking on fewer clients, if any clients at all. For as much as I love being a doula, I've been having misgivings ever since the Tebow baby was born. I think of Jason and Shelby often. I haven't stayed in touch well enough. It's hard to do. The baby has suffered irreparable damage. I don't know to what extent. I've started to second-guess the way I handled things in the labor and delivery room. I didn't do everything in my power to protect Shelby. I could have done more. I could have physically put myself between Dr. Feingold and my client. I call Jeanette. I tell her what happened. We talk it through. As a midwife, Jeanette is one of the few people I know familiar with my line of work. Maybe it's time, I tell her, that I set my work aside and focus on my own family for a change. She tells me the same thing I told Shelby. You have to do what's best for your family. But, Meredith, she says, you handled Dr. Feingold exactly as I would have. Don't ever let yourself think you're not a good doula or that you didn't do everything you could for that woman. You're only human. All the time, I find myself staring out the window at Marty and Cassandra's house. I think that if Cassandra had the cunningness to buy a burner phone, to follow me around town and send intimidating texts, she's capable of much worse. Are the texts only empty threats? Or do I have a reason to fear for my family and my safety?
Leo. Now. On your fourth day home, I go back to school. I walk there, taking the long way. I still can't walk by our old babysitter's house without feeling the need to dry heave, even though last I heard, she and her husband don't live there anymore. Dad says not to talk to the kids at school about you. If anyone asks, I'm supposed to say my dad told me not to talk about it. That goes over about as well as to be expected. During lunch, I get my cafeteria tray knocked out of my hands because I won't spill the details of what happened to you. The tray falls. Dr. Carmichael blames me because by the time it hits the ground, Adam Beltner is nowhere around. Everyone laughs. Look at that idiot, they say. Dr. Carmichael makes me clean it up. By the time I do, there's no time left to eat. I go hungry. I get nudged during the day. Kids ask questions that I ignore. They throw things at me. They call me names. Jagoff. Jerkweed. They stare. They point fingers and laugh. The effing reporters have snapped about a gazillion pictures of you since you've been home. They're in the paper. They're all over Snapchat and Instagram. Kids keep sharing them on their own stories, like what's happened to you is their own tragedy. Everyone's seen the pictures. It's the same picture, taken from 10 angles by 10 different photographers. In them, you're red, covered with blisters on your arms and face. Bleach burns, the doctor said. Second degree. They'll probably scar. Your clothes don't fit right. You haven't bathed in 11 years. You look like trash. I overhear some kid call you a burrito face because of the blisters and burns. I go to punch him in the face, but Piper Hanaka gets in my way. Ignore him, Leo. He's like just trying to screw with you. Don't give him what he wants. Piper Hanaka is your age. She's 2 years older than me. She's a senior, practically engaged to some guy she's been dating since freshman year. Rumor has it, they're going to different colleges next year. They've decided to break up before they go. Neither wants to hold the other back, and if it's meant to be, I've overheard her say, it will be. It sounds very mature, and also stupid as shit. But it means that in exactly 8 months from now, Piper Hanaka will be single. Not that she'd ever want me. Do you remember Piper Hanaka? You used to be friends. I don't remember that. She told me once, all cloak and dagger-like in the hall. Just sidled up to me at my locker and said she had a dream about you. I went mute. I didn't know what to say, so I said nothing. Then she said, do you want to know what it was about, Leo? I said, okay, I guess. She told me about her dream. How the two of you were trying to pick all the woolly bear caterpillars up off the street. You did it so the cars couldn't drive over them. You'd gather them in the palms of your hands, then run them back to the trees. You'd set them on the leaves, watch them walk away. By the time they reached the end of the leaf, they were moths. They could fly. In her dream, you were still six. I thought it might mean something. I thought her dream might be premonitory, like you were dead, and you'd turned into an angel with wings and were flying to heaven. But as it turned out, it was just a dream. Not all dreams mean something. She said, I still think about her, you know. I think about how we used to hang out when we were kids. I wonder if we'd still be friends if she never went away. Went away, she said, like you had some choice in the matter. I didn't hold it against her. She's the only one who ever talked to me about you in a way that wasn't brutally honest. She's also one of the few who doesn't give in to the herd mentality and make fun of me. Piper Hanaka used to live across the street from us. You and she used to ride your bikes on the sidewalk, do cartwheels, play house, climb trees. I don't remember any of it. Any knowledge I have is secondhand from Dad. Piper and her family moved after everything happened. I don't remember them living there. As far as I know, that's always been old Mr. Murphy's house. But Dad said their house was on the market within 5 days of Mom being dead. They didn't go far, because Piper is still at the same school as me. They stayed in town, just on the other side of it, where they didn't have to look out their window and be reminded that bad things happen to good people every day. It's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. All the time, we're closer to disaster than we think. I asked Dad to put our house on the market, too. I wanted to get up and go. I wanted to start over somewhere else as someone new, where no one had heard of Mom and you. Dad said no, because what if you came back and couldn't find us? As long as you were gone, he would never leave. Time stood still in your absence. To be straight, Piper Hanaka and I are not friends. Piper Hanaka is way too cool to be my friend. In case you didn't realize it by now, I have no friends. That said, Piper Hanaka doesn't want to see me get expelled for punching some douchebag in the face. She stands in between him and me until I back down and leave.
Kate, 11 years before. May. The rest of the way home, we're on the lookout for the car. Both B and I are circumspect, though I start to second-guess myself, wondering if the car was following us at all, or if it was just another car having as much difficulty navigating the roads as I was. I may never know. By the time we reach our neighborhood, the rain has let up. Still, everything is gray and nondescript. The streets are empty. The trees hang heavy with rainwater. Their branches, what's left of them anyway, reaching down to touch the ground. The weaker of the twigs have fallen, unable to sustain the weight of the water or the force of the wind. Hail remains, melting on lawns. I slip down the alley behind our house. Most of the homes in the neighborhood have alleys to provide rear access because it keeps things uniform and aesthetically pleasing from the street. The alley is narrow. It's wide enough that two cars going in opposite directions can just eke through. I pull down the alley going slowly. About 100 feet ahead, Josh returns from wherever he's been. I pull into our driveway and park, and B and I get out, making our way to him. He stands by his car waiting. No one is allowed in the Dickey's garage because it's been deemed a potential crime scene. Yellow caution tape surrounds the door. I see B's eyes go to it and then move away. It's hard to believe something bad may have happened there.
I was out searching for Meredith and Delilah, Josh says, before we can even think to ask.
He wears a button-down shirt, and only half of the shirt is still tucked into the waistband of his jeans. He isn't wearing a belt, and his jeans slip. He grabs a hold of the waistband and hikes them back into place. His eyes are fat. I didn't know the search party was headed out again today, I say, feeling guilty that B and I weren't there to help. Tomorrow, I'm scheduled to work at the animal hospital, so I won't be able to help then either.
It wasn't. Not with these storms. But I couldn't just sit around all day doing nothing,
he says. B asks Josh where he looked, and he rattles off a half dozen locations, mostly parks and other outdoorsy places that Meredith likes to take the kids. Though with the weather as inclement as it is, there's no chance they would have been at a park.
Stupid, right?
He asks. His dog, Wyatt, spent the day alone because Josh didn't have the patience to take him, worried the dog would only slow him down. There are only so many places he could bring a dog. He tells us he needs to take Wyatt for a quick walk and then go get Leo, who's with the sitter. He's overwhelmed. He's strung out. Have you told Leo anything about Meredith and Delilah? I ask. Josh closes his eyes. He shakes his head vigorously. He looks at me.
I can't. What would I even say?
He asks, venting about how it's all so tiresome and incapacitating because he doesn't want to walk the dog or get Leo. All he wants to do is be out there, searching for Meredith and Delilah. He hates being home, being idle. It feels shiftless. He should be pounding the pavement looking for his family. Leo is your family, Josh. He needs you as much as Meredith and Delilah do. Let me walk Wyatt, Bea offers. Kate and I will keep him while you go get Leo. Spend time with him. Talk to him. He's a smart boy, an observant boy. Surely he realizes that Meredith and Delilah aren't here. When is he ever without Delilah? She asks. It's conceivable that Meredith has been at work all this time. She has had back-to-back births before. But other than the few hours Delilah is at school, she and Leo are never apart. Bea goes with Josh to retrieve Wyatt. I let myself into the house alone, slipping past the workers. They don't stop what they're doing, but I see their gazes fall to me out of the corners of their eyes. Their conversation, spoken in some other language that I don't speak, goes on. I don't know what they're saying. I climb the stairs and move down the hall for the bedroom. It's dark in the hall. The light from the windows doesn't reach here. I lock the bedroom door and then slide a chair in front of it for good measure. Ordinarily, I wouldn't ever shower with workers in the house, but I can't bear to go another second without. In the bathroom, I undress. I hear the workers in our house. I hear their tools and their noise, rehabbing the second bath down the hall. With the other bathroom inoperative, this is the only one in use for now. It's the one in Bea's in my bedroom, which means that when we're not home, the men are in here doing their business. It's no longer just mine and Bea's because they leave the toilet seat up, our own towels tilted and wet. I stand in the shower, letting hot water wash away the memory of Dr. Feingold's hands. I lather the soap onto a loofah and scour my body with it. I pile on shampoo and scrub at my scalp, though he didn't touch my scalp. But as far as I'm concerned, his hands have been everywhere. By the time I come out of the bathroom and dress, the men are packing up their things and leaving. I watch through the slats in the blinds as they load their belongings into their trucks and drive slowly away. The earth outside is sopping wet. The puddles are profuse. Not even puddles anymore, but now flooding. The sky is darkening, though I don't know if it's due to the weather or because night will be here soon. It's hard to say anymore. I can't remember the last time we saw the sun. That alone would be depressing enough. But with what's happened with Shelby, with Meredith and Delilah, things are dire. Bea and Wyatt are just back from their walk. I watch them out the window as they arrive home, coming up the path into the front door. The door closes and Bea's voice calls for me up the stairs. Be right down, I call, as I run a comb through my wet hair. Back in the bathroom, I towel dry the ends of it and throw it into a messy bun. I gather the towels to wash, heading downstairs, watching where I step because our home is covered in rosin paper and plastic sheeting, and sometimes nails or debris get dropped. We have to clean up after the workers leave. Zeus is here somewhere, but wherever he is, he's hiding. He doesn't like having people in the house any more than I do. Bea changes out of her wet clothes and into something dry. She pours me a glass of wine and brings it to the sofa, where we sit with Wyatt at our feet. Dusk falls, and the house turns dark. Bea and I make our way around, turning on lights. We reconvene on the sofa. I've been thinking, she says. I sip from my glass of wine. About what? Just because Dr. Feingold is a creep, she says. Doesn't make him a murderer. Why do you say that? What if he lied about knowing Meredith, not because he's somehow involved in her disappearance, but because of the malpractice suit? Think about it, Kate. If he believed for a second that you were pregnant and in need of a doula, he wouldn't want Meredith to scare you away. Meredith would have badmouthed him after what went down with that Tebow baby. It's bad for business. I consider what she said. I guess you're right, I tell her, though this doesn't make him any less culpable in my mind. He's still on the suspect list as far as I'm concerned. I think we can't just gloss over the husband, B says. He and Shelby had problems. He was the only one who knew she'd gone running that night. He had a motive to kill her, and he had the means. And maybe Josh is right. Maybe the husband only said what he said about Dr. Feingold to clear his own name. But the midwife backed his story up. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm suggesting the husband had a hidden agenda in telling us. Because let's be honest, Kate, until he did, we were convinced he was a wife killer. But now we're not so sure. He planted that seed of reasonable doubt. B is right. He did. Before yesterday, there was only one name on my suspect list, and now there are two. But we saw Dr. Feingold, I argue, still feeling the way he forced my knees apart, the way he thrust his fingers inside me as if hollowing out a pumpkin. Hours later, I could convince myself that he didn't do anything unethical. It was the rote, forceful way that he did it that left me feeling violated and strange. But along with the knowledge of Shelby's murder, with the image of him dragging her cold, naked body out there into the woods and discarding her like trash. We spoke to him. The man is detestable. He's a swine. That doesn't make him a murderer. We need to call the police. We need to tell them what we know. Bea agrees. Her cell phone is on the coffee table. She grabs it and looks up a non-emergency number. The police are conducting their own investigation. They've already questioned Jason Tebow about a bajillion times and are trying to do a deep dive into the contents of Meredith's phone, though without the phone itself, that's proven problematic. B says to whoever answers, I have some information on the Dickey missing persons case. She's put on hold. While we wait, I drink my wine, liking the way it both dulls my senses and gives me courage. I ask B to put the phone on speaker so that I can listen in. She does, scooching closer to me with the phone between us. A female detective comes on the line. I heard you have some information for me, she says. Yes, I say, over-anxious to speak. And who am I speaking to? It's B who tells her. Okay, Kate and B, she says. What do you know? I go first. I start with Cassandra Hanaka from across the street. I feel extra guilty that we've been sitting on this information for over 24 hours now and haven't told. But with the discovery of the body yesterday and all the intense emotion that went with it, B and I let it slip. I tell the detective about the night Cassandra was up with her son, seeing people in Josh and Meredith's yard late at night. We were thinking that maybe one of the neighbors has a home security system, and it caught a glimpse of them. B and I don't have a home security system. It never felt necessary until now. Unfortunately, she says. Many home security systems nowadays only offer a live feed. They don't record. And those that do only store the footage for a couple of days. But we'll look into it. We might just get lucky. I'll talk to Mr. Dickey, too, and see if he recalls anything amiss that night or the following day. What day did Mrs. Hanaka say this happened? She asks. She didn't, I say. She wasn't sure. She could only guess about a week or two ago. B goes next. She tells the detective about the Tebow's malpractice suit against Dr. Feingold, because there's another possible suspect to consider besides Jason Tebow. The detective already knows about the malpractice suit. What she doesn't know is that Meredith was Shelby's doula. B tells her. I'm ashamed to admit to our own run-in with Dr. Feingold. I let B tell the detective, B feeling embarrassed as she does. The detective tells us in the future to leave the police work to the police. The detective says that she'll be in touch. We end the call. B and I turn on the TV. I drink my wine and try to wind down as another thunderstorm tears through town. But I can't relax, because I can't stop thinking about Meredith and Delilah out there in this rain, cold and scared and wet. The lightning is rapid fire. The thunder is so intense it feels like the entire house will give. And then, suddenly it's black in the house. The storm has stolen our power from us. The blackness is so unexpected that my heart nearly stops. Without meaning to, I scream. The low drone of the refrigerator goes suddenly quiet. The dryer, a ceiling fan, and the TV turn off. The house is silent, abnormally so. I never noticed the whir of the ceiling fan, but the absence of it I do. The absence of it is deafening. Wyatt begins to moan at my feet, and I rub his ears, saying, "It's okay. It's okay." But I don't know that it is. I push myself from the seat, leaving in search of candles and flashlights, coming back with as many as I can find. Until now, we'd been one of the lucky ones with power. Our luck has run out, it seems. I sit beside B. I light the candles, setting them on the coffee table. I hand B a flashlight, and then use mine to scan the darkest corners of the room. The furniture startles me as I try and make sense of the shadows to understand that they're not human, but synthetic. No one is here but B and me. Outside, the storm rages. It's more thunder and wind than anything. B and I sit on the sofa with Wyatt, listening for the sound of the tornado siren to warn us to run and hide. The wind rouses the trees and shrubs. Their limbs scrape against the side of the house, against the window screens, making them rasp. And then, a door from upstairs slams suddenly closed and B and I both scream. "Maybe it was Zeus," I say, which is ridiculous because our 10-pound cat could never slam a door like that. "The workers," B says, trying to be the rational one, though I don't know that either of us believe it. "They must have left a window open. The wind blew the door closed," she says, though neither of us has the courage to go see, though if the window is open, it will soon take in water. We scoot closer together on the sofa, clinging to each other. I'm scared. I feel vulnerable and exposed. I hate feeling vulnerable. I push myself up off the sofa again and go to the coat rack. "What are you doing?" B asks. I don't say. She shines her flashlight on me, watching as I go. Beside the coat rack is an umbrella stand. I reach my hand in and take out our giant golf umbrella. We may need something to protect ourselves with. My eyes reach up from the umbrella stand. They move to the window. The windows on our home are ornamental, made to look pretty more than to be practical. Even on the brightest of days, our house is dark. The windows don't let much light in. Now they're lined with rain. But none of that matters, because no matter how small or ornamental, the thing that catches my eye when I look out the window is that the homes across the street from us are still lit. Unlike ours, they're not dark. Porch and garage lights are on. Inside the homes, I see people mulling about, backlit by bedroom and living room lights. Across the street, I see Marty, Cassandra's husband, standing in the foyer of his own home beneath a caged chandelier. The chandelier is radiant. Yellow light spills down on him. "B," I breathe out, but my throat is so bone dry that I can hardly speak. I choke on the words. Tears prick my eyes. What I need to tell her is that the power outage isn't citywide. I need to say that the power to our house alone has been cut. Our circuit breaker is outside, that metal box recessed into the sidewall. Someone slipped around the periphery of our home in the dark. They went to the circuit breaker and purposefully turn the main breaker handle off. The only way to get the power back on is for B or me to go outside and turn it on. The circuit breaker isn't easy to find. It's camouflaged, painted yellow to match.